Radio.ie hosts the Irish History Show podcast because history matters. Radio turns 100 years young this year. Radio's history is powered by Radio Archives. For radio archiving solutions from people passionate about radio, visit radio.ie.
Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show. My name is Cathal Brennan, and as always, I'm joined by my co-presenter, John Dorney from theirishstory.com. Please check out our friends from radio.ie for all your radio archiving solutions. You can find this episode and all our previous episodes on our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. You can follow us on Twitter, at Irish History Pod, or on Facebook, facebook.com/theirishhistoryshow. If you get a chance, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help us. And if you hear an episode you like, please share it on your social media. We are really grateful for all the support we receive from you, the listeners. John has set up a Patreon for the Irish History Show and the Irish Story. And if you would consider supporting the show, there is a link in the show notes. On this episode of the show, we are going to be discussing the Birmingham Six with two very special guests, as we are almost at the 50th anniversary of the Birmingham pub bombings on the 21st of November 1974, in which 21 people lost their lives. Our first guest is Chris Mullen. Chris Mullen is a journalist, author and diarist, and from 1987 to 2010 was the Labour Party MP for Sunderland South. His work with Granada Television's World in Action Current Affairs series and his 1986 book, Error of Judgment, The Truth About the Birmingham Pub Bombings, were integral in proving the innocence of the Birmingham Six. Error of Judgment was described by the author and journalist Sebastian Falks as one of the greatest feats ever achieved by an investigative journalist, and it's hard to disagree with that assessment. A new edition of Error of Judgment has been published this year to mark 50 years since the Birmingham bombings. Our second guest is Dr. Michael Flavin from the School of Global Affairs in King's College, London. Michael's novels include The Voice Hearer and One Small Step. He has written many articles on the Troubles, and a lot of his writings draw on his experience growing up in the Irish community in Birmingham in the 1970s. Michael's latest novel is Long Is the Way and is due to be published next year. You're both very welcome to the show. Michael, if we can start off with you, can you tell us about growing up in the Irish community in Birmingham and how well integrated was it into the city? And also, how was it impacted by the IRA's bombing campaign in England?
Well, the first thing to note there was it was very easy to grow up as an Irish person in Birmingham. It was very easy to live as an Irish person in Birmingham. There was the Irish Centre in Digbeth, a community hub. We all went to Catholic primary schools. We all went to Mass religiously, in every sense of the adverb, on Sunday. My home, if you open the front door, the first thing you would see would be the holy water font. You know, people had the Sacred Heart on the wall. It was essentially a displaced Irish community. And I think it was a major contributor to post-war British society. At the economic base, you had a large amount of construction workers who physically rebuilt Britain after the war. You had the new NHS service staffed with a significant number of Irish nurses and auxiliary staff, and the transport system on which my own father worked. The buses in Birmingham, there were loads of Irish working there. So for a long time, it was very easy to live as an Irish person in Birmingham. Of course, the mood music changed dramatically in November 1974. I think before that, although the mainland campaign was there, you know, it didn't impact directly on Birmingham. I mean, a week prior to the bombings, there was a bomb in Coventry, which I think was an important catalyst for Birmingham. But there was this very, very sudden change after the Birmingham pub bombings. And what happened was the actions of a tiny number of people were conflated with an entire community. If you look at the social history of the period, you've got Irish people in Birmingham being refused service in shops, traders in Birmingham's Bullring Market refusing to handle Irish goods, checks drawn against Irish banks returned in shops too. On the one level, it was very sudden, But part of what I argue, both in my fiction and non-fiction writing, it wasn't a question of the Birmingham pub bombings causing anti-Irish racism. It was there all along, and I think it's deeply embedded in Britain's colonial relationship with Ireland going right back to the middle of the 12th century. But all that which was kind of latent and very much below the surface came to the surface very dramatically in the aftermath of the Birmingham pub bombing. So to be a part of that community, to go through a very unwelcome transformation from being an accepted community to being a pariah.
Now, Chris, we can't talk about the Birmingham pub bombings without talking about the immediate atmosphere that preceded them. So, can you tell us a little bit about the atmosphere beforehand, particularly the bombings in Guildford and Woolwich?
Yes, well, the IRA, as you know, began, I think, a bit earlier than 1974, what it called its mainland campaign of bombings. I think the first was a bomb outside the Old Bailey, the Courts of Justice in central London. But the 1974 was the worst year. It's when they really stepped up. It started in February 74 when somebody placed a bomb on a coach filled with soldiers and their families on the M62 motorway, which blew up, killing, I think, a dozen people and seriously injuring many others. That was in February. And eventually, a young woman called Judith Ward was arrested for that and sentenced to 30 years in prison. She, as it turned out, was entirely innocent too. Then the next thing that happened, a wave of bombings and shootings started in London. It was thought to have culminated in the Guildford and Woolwich pub bombings, in which again a lot of people died or were seriously injured. The pubs in Guildford were used by soldiers, though there were many people who were not soldiers there, and ditto the pub in Woolwich was near a military base. And for that, a total of 11 people were arrested and sentenced mainly, in fact, entirely on the basis of confessions extracted in police custody. But no sooner had they all been sent down than the bombings and shootings continued, and they got the wrong people entirely for that too. And then the culmination of that year was the Birmingham pub bombings, but there'd already been about 50 bombings in the West Midlands carried out by people of Irish origin based in the West Midlands. And they were mainly targeted, they were entirely targeted against property until the pub bombings. And even the pub bombings, I think, were intended to attack the tax office, which was above one of the pubs, and the Rotunda, which is a large office block in the centre of Birmingham. It's a well-known landmark that the IRA were trying to put out of business. And that led to the deaths of 21 people. And again, another six innocent people were convicted, again, not just on the basis of confessions in that case, but on the basis of what turned out to be dodgy forensic evidence. So that's a total of 18 people arrested for the bombings in 1974. And in every case, the British criminal justice system got the wrong people.
Just on the kind of legislative background, Chris, they introduced around that time the Prevention of Terrorism Act. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yes, that was actually brought in, although it led to the harassment of a lot of people coming from Ireland to the UK. That was brought in by Roy Jenkins, a pretty liberal Home Secretary, and it was brought in because it was thought to be the only way of resisting the return of the death penalty, which he was very anxious to avoid. So that's the background to it. I mean, popular feeling in the UK was running very high as a result of all these bombings and killings. And Michael's just described how the feeling that changed in Birmingham. And indeed, there were people that were going on the march, workers at Longbridge, the big car plant, downing tools and marching with signs calling for the return of the death penalty. This was within days of the pub bombings. So the pressure was very real. And the Prevention of Terrorism Act, I think, was the minimum he thought he could get away with.
Now, Michael, you've described there earlier the effects of the bombing in terms of how Birmingham people felt and the anger that was felt within the Birmingham English community. How did the Irish community feel when the bombs went off?
I think there was a certain amount of withdrawal at first. I mean, certainly people like my parents, it was very much about keeping a low profile. There's a vignette in my novel, One Small Step, in which I describe that we had, like a lot of Irish families had, we had a vinyl record collection, and it was all overwhelmingly Irish music, the Gallaghers, Cayley Band and things like that. But we had one record which was called Songs of Irish Resistance by Hugh Traynor, and it was simply some bloke and an accordion and a little drum, doing the classics of the repertoire, Boys of the Old Brigade and Nation Once Again. I think on that, my parents were cultural nationalists. They weren't going on marches, they weren't signing petitions, but we had what Irish families had, which was that musical tradition of resistance to British rule. And that was a vinyl record that my parents owned. But what I recall is after the bombings, it went missing from the house. So my parents obviously got rid of it. They were frightened of the next knock at the door. Unless this seemed like just paranoia, a work colleague of my father's got taken in under the new Prevention of Terrorism Act. He was also on the buses, but used to organise benefit gigs in Birmingham pubs and clubs for the families of internees. Internment without trial had been introduced August 1971. So that was the extent of his involvement, was, generating money to send back to the North. But he literally got taken in. And so I think, what was the next knock at the door going to be? I think it was, I think how the Birmingham Irish reacted initially afterwards, I think there was that sense of keep your head down, keep out of the way, don't open your mouth. It was very, very fearful. An odd thing about it, though, is the way the Irishness did seep back. I'm not particularly into Irish culture myself, but I recall when I first started going out in my teens, about 1982, if you went to the Irish Centre, I mean, the IRA songs were still on the band's repertoires. You would still hear James Connolly, the Irish Rebel, We're on the One Road. So it was strange. It did seep back. It didn't stay suppressed. Maybe it started to be articulated again within the safe four walls of the Irish Centre and certain Irish pubs. There were suburbs of Birmingham like Borstal Heath, Sparkbrook, Sparkill that had very Irish populations. So it wasn't an eradication there, but for a while there was definitely a suppression before that started to seep its way back.
Well, that's something as well when we talk about one of the people who's tangentially involved in the Birmingham Six, James McDaid, the IRA member who was blown up. Would it be right to say that even though everyone doesn't agree with his politics, he's still part of the Irish community? And people wouldn't necessarily feel themselves IRA supporters who would, be sending some money to pay for a funeral or have a mass carriage or things like that.
I agree with that absolutely. And one of the really problematic things in the wake of the pub bombings was if you were even on the periphery of the periphery, if you were just people like my parents who owned a record, that could compromise you in the general climate of fear and paranoia. So, James McDaid would sing at the pubs and clubs. I do recall a few times as a child, my parents would take us to the Birmingham Irish Centre. And, once the evening was at an end and the band had stopped playing and the bar was serving last orders, a sing song would just kind of rise up around the tables. And it'd often be one man starting it. And it was invariably, from the rebel repertoire. I don't think you can draw a causal line from that. Well, therefore, they must be involved. But I think in that immediate, when the troubles were at their height, those kind of lazy conflations were made and led to a lot of people being suspect who were doing nothing more in practice than articulating their Irishness in the country to which they come, which is an absolute staple of the immigrant experience. For what it's worth, I mean, James McDaid is buried in Milltown Cemetery. His role is recognised. There's no questioning that he was an IRA man who died on active service at the Coventry Telephone Exchange. But there was some very easy, reductive, and dangerous links formed between this tiny kernel of activists and an entire community which legitimately had a problem with internment and legitimately had a problem with Bloody Sunday. But to suddenly group everyone in that net and to castigate the entire community, that was the experience that Birmingham Irish underwent in the mid-70s.
Now, Chris, against that background, can you tell us about the police investigation and the six men who were arrested for the bombings in Birmingham?
Yes. Well, five of them caught a train that left New Street Station, which is very close to the scene of both bombings, and they were going to Ireland, and some of them were going to the funeral of James McDaid, and perhaps all five of them were, although some had other reasons for going as well. to visit relatives and sick parents and so forth. And they were arrested at Morecambe and taken to Morecambe police station. And a forensic scientist called Dr. Frank Skews, the Home Office forensic scientist, was called out. And he tested their hands with a test known as the grease test, which was supposed to be sort of preliminary test for explosives. But it was only supposed to be preliminary. It was supposed to take the sample back to the laboratory and run it through a spectrometer, which was 100 times more sensitive. But he was called out and he tested their hands and he said he found positives on two of them. And by this time, a posse of West Midlands police officers had travelled up the motorway on hearing of the arrests and were in Morecambe's police station, pacing up and down, waiting for Dr. Skews's results. And as soon as Dr. Skews told them, which he had no business to do, that he got two positive results, they began a program of violence that lasted over the next 2 or 3 days and nights and resulted in four of the eventual six confessing, signing confessions. The sixth man, Hughie Callaghan, was the unluckiest of the lot. He wasn't going to Ireland that night. He owed Dick McElkenny, one of the five who was going to Ireland, £1. Which was 8 pints of Guinness, I think, in 1974. He went to pay it back and found Dick packing up his case to go to Ireland that night. So having nothing better to do, Hughie sat playing with Dick's children and then said, well, I'll come down to the station and see you off. And he just had a pint with them in the station bar and went home. And they came for him a day or two later.
Now, listening to the documentary you recently made for BBC, Chris, you know, there's some extraordinary things about the police conduct. So obviously there's beatings and mistreatment. But also at one point, policemen said to the suspects, we don't care if it was you or not. You know, we don't care if you really did the bombing. We need a conviction. It seems extraordinary.
Well, that's what Paddy Hill, who was one of the five arrested at Morecambe, alleges one of the policemen who was assaulting him said to him. The public on our gaffer's back and our gaffer's on our back and we're going to get him. We don't really care whether you've done it or not. Yeah, something like that. That's Paddy Hill's allegation. So that's only anecdotal. What I think convinced the policemen in the Birmingham case that they got the right people was Dr. Skews's tests. So I think certainly for many, many years, including long after the convictions were quashed, the feeling amongst those responsible for the convictions were that, okay, the forensic evidence may have been souped up a bit and the confessions might have been the result of violence, but we know they did it. And if you press them on the subject, they would refer back to Dr. Skews's testimony. Dr. Skews, who was a very good witness in court because he was a very experienced forensic scientist, though as it turned out, a completely incompetent one, told the court at the trial that the grease test, he had no business to do this, but this is what he said, gave him a 99% certainty that the two or three positives that he'd obtained, the individuals concerned had recently been in touch with nitroglycerine. Well, it was very hard to counter that in the absence of any other evidence to the contrary.
I mean, in the other case, in the Guildford case, the police actually seem to have suppressed alibis for the suspects. So, you know, this would strongly indicate that they really wanted convictions of these people.
Yeah, the Guildford case is much more shocking in a way because it's clear anecdotally, again, from within a day or two that they knew they got the wrong people or suspected that they got the wrong people. And they certainly knew before the Guildford and Woolwich defendants were sent down for very long periods. Within a very short time after that, they caught the actual perpetrators who were the IRA unit captured in the siege of Balcombe Street, which lasted 6 days. It was a very big event. It was all televised. Now, these were hardened professionals, and it was instantly clear that these guys were responsible for just about all the bombings and shootings that had been taking place over the previous year. And when the lead member of this unit emerged from the flat in Balcombe Street where they'd holed up, the first question that the police superintendent put to him was, what was your first job? I think he replied, the Woolwich bombing, to which the police officer says, we've already put people away for that, to which this man says, I'm saying I've never heard of them, to which the police officer replies, are you saying we've got the wrong people? And this man again repeats, I'm saying I've never heard of them. And the police officer says something to the effect that this is very serious. We shall have to look at this if you're saying that innocent people have been convicted. And the police officers, in fairness to them, these are metropolitan police officers, did report it to the Director of Public Prosecutions, but nothing happened. And they suppressed the fact that these guys were owning up to the Guildford and Woolwich pub bombings. And it was only by chance that Alistair Logan, a very diligent Guildford solicitor, who more than anybody was responsible for keeping these cases alive, heard that the Malcolm Street gang were confessing to the Guildford and Woolwich offences. And he eventually went into the prisons and interviewed them with a, he took in with him a former Metropolitan Police officer who was a very experienced interviewer. And they drew up statements, and these guys, which gave a very detailed account of what they'd done, much more detailed than the confessions beaten out of the original suspects. It was impossible to argue that they, or very difficult to argue that these guys were not wholly or in part responsible. And that was suppressed. And so this is a remarkable thing. What the Director of Public Prosecutions did in order to avoid this coming up, he hoped, at the trial of the Malcolm Street people, was he cut out all the charges for bombings that had taken place up to the arrest of the Guildford Four, so that nobody needed to talk about those in the court. And they were only charged with things that had occurred later. But when they came to trial, they all got up in court and said, as members of the IRA, we would not normally recognise a British court, but because innocent people have been convicted of offences for which we're responsible, we proposed to invite our barrister to engage in the proceedings only insofar as to draw out, I'm paraphrasing here, the record quantities of fraud and perjury that appeared to have been committed. And that's indeed what happened. And it was a tremendous embarrassment to the authorities. It made no difference to the outcome as far as the Malcolm Street people were concerned, because there was plenty of evidence that they were responsible for all sorts of mayhem. But it was a major embarrassment. So at this point, of course, since the Guildford and Woolwich case depended solely on confessions, at this point, they were entitled, with this new evidence, to an appeal. And it was unlikely that a jury would accept this here on hearing the Malcolm Street confessions. So in order to avoid taking the case back to the another jury, the Court of Appeal, headed by a very conservative judge called Lord Roskell, invoked a little-known procedure whereby the Court of Appeal could sit as a court of first instance and as a court of an appeal simultaneously, thereby three judges, thereby knocking out their right to a retrial and the appeal in one go. And the appeal took place. The Malcolm Street people appeared in the witness box and described their involvement in these cases. And the judges just sat there stony-faced and said, "We've heard nothing new, take them away." And that was it. You see, the truly shocking thing about Guildford and Woolwich is it's quite clear that everybody involved, up to the highest levels of the judicial system, knew they got the wrong people. Birmingham, they believed they got the right people. Judith Ward, they may have believed they got the right people, not sure about that. But in Guildford and Woolwich, they knew from the moment the Malcolm Street people owned up that they got the wrong people, and they chose not to face up to it, presumably for fear that it would undermine confidence in the British judicial system, though, of course, nothing undermines confidence in a judicial system so much as the feeling that they're willing to put innocent people away in order to avoid embarrassment. And that's what happened.
Now, Michael, the Irish community in Birmingham is not that large. At what point, I mean, people know each other, people know each other's families. At what point in the trial do people realise these men are obviously innocent? And what was the grassroots organisation in terms of campaigning to get these men off?
I think there was actually very little initially, and again, I think the Irish community was happy to cover over it. And like I was saying, this rather the stoic say not, whatever you say, say nothing approach, and don't draw attention to yourself. And I think it was, works of particularly journalists like Chris and others who started to build that momentum and just ask questions. Because, I mean, Chris makes the very valid point that Guildford was transparent. If you look at those people, I mean, Chris mentioned that Hughie Callaghan was very unlucky because he didn't even travel on the train to Belfast when the other five got arrested. I think he's very lucky compared to Gerry Conlon and Paul Hill, who, far from being in the IRA, had been chased out of Belfast by the IRA. So to be chased out by the IRA and then get life sentences for having undertaken IRA bombings, I just, it's just sort of catastrophic what happened there. I think in the case of Birmingham, the momentum was built elsewhere. And what I found was I left Birmingham in 1987 to go to university. And I found two things. One, you could wear your Irishness a lot more lightly outside Birmingham. So being Irish in Manchester was not a problem. You wouldn't hide the fact that you were Irish. You wouldn't downplay it because there was a kind of fairly thriving and busy Irish community. I do recall going to see the Wolftones in Manchester with another lad who had Irish parents. I mean, so I wasn't a big fan of the music, but I was a young gentleman and it was a pleasant night out. And I recall there that there were people with buckets outside collecting money to try and fund the campaign to free the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four. So you became aware then that there was grassroots momentum building up to it. And then, of course, the World in Action programs to which Chris was central. Again, the momentum kept building and building and building. And I think one of the things that became apparent from Chris's work was just how flawed these convictions were. Paddy Hill borrowing money from a local order of nuns to get the ferry back to Belfast. That's, if you're some crack IRA hit squad, you're probably not having to borrow a few shillings off nuns to pay your boat train back to Belfast. I think the statements about carrying the bombs in plastic bags when forensic examination of the scene showed they were in suitcases with D handles, that where they'd been planted in the bombs was all wrong. And if we just remember some of the things that happened there, I think in Guildford, the judge said to Condon, "I'm surprised you weren't charged with treason to the crown, which still carries the death penalty, and I'd have had no trouble in passing that." And if you look at the judge in the Birmingham Six case, who described it as the clearest and most overwhelming evidence I have heard, I mean, Chris makes that point that the conspiracy travelled very far and very high with some very troubling repercussions for what that says about British police, British media, British judiciary. And when they decided to target the Irish community in the UK, well, on one level, they made a pretty damn good job of it. Because if you've got the police, the media, and the courts all acting in concert, you can achieve a great deal without being answerable to anyone. So I think that the work to free the Birmingham Six was slow, painstaking, characterized by appalling setback and frustration with one failed appeal where the judges were utterly contemptuous, saying the longer this has gone on, the more we're convinced the original judgment was right. And it was just predicated on just such appalling fallacies and violence and the complete misusage of forensic evidence. For anyone who could be calm and objective, the holes in those cases were wide open for a long time. And the reluctance of the British establishment to put it hands up and say, "Yes, we've made a terrible mistake," is pretty contemptible. And those lives were ruined. Chris mentioned Judith Ward, but we shouldn't mention who wasn't Irish, but we should mention Carol Richardson, who was 17 years old, English. She just happened to be the girlfriend of one of the other people put away for Guildford. And at the time of the bombing, she was at a rock gig in Elephant and Castle in South London. And yet she still goes down for it. So I think as time passes and people say, "Oh, we don't want to talk about that anymore," quite the contrary. I think we should be insistent on still talking about that because the narrative of the Troubles and its repercussions beyond the six counties is a very live and contested narrative to which, thankfully, programs like yours can contribute.
Well, Chris, Michael mentioned it there, and this really becomes an integral part of the campaign to free the Birmingham Six. Your journalism and the World in Action current affairs programme on Granada Television. Can you tell us about how you became involved with the programme and how the programme began to really look into the case of the Birmingham Six?
Yes, back in 1975 or six, around the time of these convictions, I had a friend called Peter Chippendale, who was a journalist on The Guardian, and he'd attended the trial of the Birmingham Six and the appeal of the Guildford Four. And he said that in both cases, he thought they got the wrong people. And so my attention was drawn to this from that moment onwards, although I wasn't in a position to do very much about it. And I started to take an interest as these cases wound their way through the appeal courts and so on. I persuaded a publisher in 1981 to commission a book initially on both cases because I was interested in both of them. But I soon realized that actually you had to focus on one or the other. There was so much to go into. So I focused on Birmingham, and Yorkshire Television eventually focused on Guildford and Woolwich. And I eventually persuaded my friend Ray Fitzwalter, who was the editor of World in Action, which was the premier documentary series in British television in those days, to take me on temporarily to see if we could come up with anything new that will enable us to get these cases reopened. And I also wrote the book. And so that's how I became involved. We made three programs for World in Action, three documentaries. One destroyed the forensic evidence. One blew a hole but was not conclusive in the police evidence. And the third one was an interview with one of the actual bombers who I had tracked down by that time. And when I worked for World in Action, they were not initially interested in pursuing the whodunit aspects of the case, even though it always seemed to me that you could go on knocking down the evidence against these guys till the cows came home. You wouldn't prove they hadn't done it, only that the case against them was weak. To prove they hadn't done it, and Peter Chippendale said this to me in the mid-1970s, to prove they hadn't done it, you had to find the actual culprits and persuade them to own up in sufficient detail as it wasn't possible for anybody to go on pretending they got the real people. So that's what I set out to do.
I mean, one of the features of the Northern Ireland conflict and the Troubles is that there's never an amnesty, of course. So people are not actually keen on admitting they did stuff generally. How did you get a bomber to admit that he had done the Birmingham bombings?
Well, I sort of engaged in a process of detective work of the sort I might have commended to the West Midlands Police had they been interested. I started, there were quite a lot of people planting bombs in and around the West Midlands in the mid-1970s, in 1974 in particular, and half of them were in jail. So they couldn't have been responsible for the big one. But what they did know, of course, was who was left outside after they'd been caught. And so I went and interviewed each of them in the prisons. And once they understood that my purpose was to rescue the innocent and not to bring the guilty to justice, because I wasn't capable of that, I don't have powers of arrest or anything like that, they to a greater or lesser degree cooperated. Most of them, I think, didn't know who'd done the big one. They had a rough idea, I think. They had their suspicions. But what they did know was who was left outside. And so I came away eventually with a short list of potential candidates for the big one, a seven or eight people. And I began to work my way around them, knowing that in due course I would come to the bombers. And in addition, there was one name, that of Michael Murray, who was a crane driver in Birmingham, whose name had been mentioned from the outset. Indeed, he was put on trial alongside the Birmingham Six, and it was extremely damaging to them because he was a real IRA man in the dock who didn't hide the fact that he was, who he gave only his name, rank, and number, so to speak. Two of the Birmingham Six were his work colleagues. They worked in the same factory. And all that was very damaging. So, anyway, my first port of call was Michael Murray, who had served a 12-year sentence for some of the other bombings, but never been charged with the big one. And he, unsurprisingly, was not very keen to see me. But eventually, through various intermediaries, he did agree. And I interviewed him three times. And he gave me an accurate account of what had happened, including his own role. He said four people had been responsible for the bombings, of whom he was one. That he was one of two people who made both bombs, and two people had planted both bombs. He accidentally let slip the identity of one of the others, who I also tracked down. But I knew that it wasn't enough to say you'd met the person who made the bombs. And indeed, he said he'd made the warning telephone call that was botched, because the intention had been to give half an hour's warning so the pubs could be cleared. and that really didn't happen. He made the call, but it was he didn't give enough time for the pubs to be evacuated. So I knew that merely saying you'd met the person who made the bombs and made the warning call wasn't sufficient. You had to find one of the two planters at least. And so that's what I set out to do. And that was more difficult. I worked my way round all the people who were at liberty on the night of the 21st of November 1974, and knowing that any of them could have been responsible until I came to the actual bomber, one of the actual bombers. And then I confronted him, and he owned up in a lot of detail. Nobody had ever spoken to him before on this subject, as far as I could tell.
Chris, this is a really interesting part of the drama documentary that ITV made, Who Bombed Birmingham? And for anyone who hasn't seen it, Chris is played by John Hurt, a very famous actor. But that type of going into council flats and being brought from place to place, and it's a really fascinating detective story in and of itself. Will they reveal the truth to you or not if you push them? It must have been very, very very hair-raising, wondering what's going to happen.
I wouldn't say it was hair-raising, but I did have to go down some fairly dark alleyways in order to find the actual perpetrators. I didn't move in, incidentally, on the one who eventually owned up to having planted, being one of the two planters. I didn't move in on him until I had his name on three quite separate sources who hadn't met for a long time, couldn't possibly have conspired to mislead me, and so on. So I was quite clear I'd found the right person by the time I did challenge him. But of course, I'm very English, and I'm middle class. And if you're standing on five floors up on a rather run-down block of council flats in one of the rougher areas of Dublin, and you ring the doorbell and you say, "Hello, my name's Chris Mullin. I want to talk to you about your role in the Birmingham pub bombing," you can't always be sure of the reception you're going to receive. So yes, there were one or two moments when it might have turned ugly, but it didn't. As long as people were convinced that my interest was in saving the innocent, rescuing the innocent, and not with bringing the perpetrator or naming the perpetrators. And that was the deal, basically, why these guys talked to me. I also interviewed, as I say, all those people who were in jail at the time of the bombings that had been involved in planting bombs in and around Birmingham. This rather cuts into to Michael's description of life in Birmingham before and after the event. I always ask them what caused them to join up in the first place, because most of them were born and bred in Birmingham. They had no they were part of the Irish community in Birmingham, but they were young men. The answer was always the same. It was internment and Bloody Sunday. So both those things had a big effect, I think, on parts of the Irish community, and were certainly big recruiting agents for the IRA.
Michael, when we're talking about these World in Action programs and obviously this film as well that was broadcast, can you remember watching these at the time and what effect did these have on Irish people living in Britain?
I do remember them, and I remember particularly when the appeal came up, this kind of palpable sense of excitement that this injustice was going to be corrected. And so then when it got knocked back in very, contemptuous terms, just that sense of utter deflation. I think it was a building thing, and when the Guildford Four got released, because they got released first, you just got this sense now nothing can stop this. I remember seeing a press conference with Paul Hill, who was very agitated, and he's saying on this press conference to the camera, "Paddy Hill, you're coming home soon." He's directly addressing one of the Birmingham Six. There was this sense that it was unstoppable. There were marches. But I think those early people who put their heads above the parapet were taking a risk. It wasn't comfortable to voice these thoughts. You were putting yourself there on the line, you were visible. I mean, there's so many catastrophes and tragedies about Birmingham, one of which is that because of what happened, I can't see how the two remaining actual perpetrators will ever be brought to court unless they made confessions under oath. Now, I mean, as I understand it, two members of the four, their names are in the public domain because they've passed, they're dead now. there's a person who you can find on YouTube easily enough who's pretty voluble about his involvement in Birmingham IRA, including on that night. Yet there's one name that's not in the public domain. And there's a campaign, of course, for the relatives of those who were killed on the night. And they're in that terrible position of never being able to attain closure. But it's really hard to see the conditions in which that can ever happen. So I think for the Irish community in Birmingham, there was this kind of epiphany when they were finally released in 1991. It's happened. And you see these men, released, and just that sense of we did it, even if you've no right to the pronoun we, if all you did was, put some money in a bucket and sign a petition and talk to friends and work colleagues and fellow students about it, as people like I did. But you just felt the groundswell just got more and more unanswerable. And I think when it was clear this wasn't going to go away, and the longer these kind of spurious convictions were still clung to as no, these are the truth, the more the absurdity of that, as long as the momentum didn't relent, you had this sense that sooner or later it would have to give. I mean, I still think, I remember when I was writing One Small Step and doing as much research as possible, I looked at a website for the campaign group for the relatives. And you go on the forum there, which is probably an error because it's like looking at below the line comments on YouTube, these kind of uncensored things. But I was seeing all there, or they may not have been them, but they were involved. There was still this residual thing. And I think just generally towards Irish people, there was that sense that even if you weren't a direct activist, you were in that liminal space between sympathizer and activist, and no such connection exists. So if we think, and the thing that happened in Birmingham that happened every year since the late 50s was the St. Patrick's Day parade, which is this day of celebration of Irishness. I remember being dragged along as a child and not being particularly interested, but you got to walk along the streets, I suppose. But I mean, obviously after Birmingham, that just went. And it was gone for over 20 years. So I think, we need to recognize, an entire community was damned. Yet that entire community also had its day in 91 when the convictions were finally quashed and they were allowed to get on with what was left of their lives.
Yeah, just on that, Michael, I mean, two questions occur to me, two separate questions. But one of them is, here in Ireland and especially in the north of Ireland, there's lots of talk now about accountability for past actions and so on. It's all a big quagmire because, of course, as I said, there was never an amnesty. Amnesty for state forces is very controversial because people will argue that's the only way that victims of state forces can get justice. But people, like particularly from the unionist community, but also people who are hostile to the IRA, will say, well, how come the IRA don't have to account for anything that they did, And, what do you make of that whole argument?
I think there's validity to it. I think South Africa in the immediate aftermath of apartheid showed one way to surface all these painful truths by a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So anyone who testified it couldn't be prosecuted for what they said. And I think even in the Bloody Sunday report, the fact that Martin McGuinness was able to say there, that he, whereas Gerry Adams has never said that he was in the IRA, Martin McGuinness on that day said, in his evidence said he was second in command of Derry IRA on that day, which rather begs the question of who was first in command. I'm not quite sure I buy the second in command argument, but that's a separate point. But I think the South African example showed, look, create a forum in which painful truths can be brought to the surface. Because I think the alternative is to let them fester. And then you can start to get some very unhealthy conspiratorial narratives that just fuel resentment on both sides. So I think, yeah, that's valid. You say, well, hang on, if party A has to step forward and say, we did this, we did that, how come Party B gets a free pass on that? I think you have to create a level playing field. But I think now that we're in the post-conflict phase, but peace process, I'd stress the word process. It can't be peace stasis. It's still an evolving situation in Ireland. There is still a constitutional issue. I think there's very interesting things happening around the island's future events. And I think Mary Lou McDonald, who was at the Labour Party conference recently, made the very clear point that the unionist demographic veto, that there was always, while a majority of people of the six counties wanted to remain constitutionally part of the United Kingdom, but that demographic veto has gone and it isn't coming back. So I think that's starting to create that ground up pressure towards revisiting the constitutional settlement. But as part of that, I think it's what's so important. We're in this post-conflict phase. There's a risk of things being forgotten, to just keep working on the narrative and try and surface as much of the truth as we can. I think there is a space for having a collective voicing of who did what when, because I think without airing those truths, Birmingham Guildford showed us you can try and suppress the truth, but over the long run, you're going to struggle.
Yeah, and just before we move back to Chris, I have one more for you, Michael. So, do you see parallels with modern immigrant communities in Britain? I mean, I'm particularly thinking of the Muslim community in places like Birmingham and elsewhere. So they're associated with the idea of terrorism and so on. And it's very difficult for people to, on the one hand, disassociate themselves from community by condemning, but on the other hand, being associated with terrorism. Are they falling into the same trap in Britain to any extent?
I absolutely agree with that. And I think it's one of the, I think there's a lot to be kind of encouraged by just such a long campaign against overwhelming odds, which yet worked and the miscarriage of justice was acknowledged. But when you see 21st century Islamophobia, I mean, you can't just do a simple lazy conflation between the two, but you cannot either, in my view, ignore the similarities. Because what we're seeing is an entire community getting conflated with the actions of a tiny number of people. You know, I teach in a university in central London. We have, you know, different populations of students, and to hear of some of the just casual and not so casual invasive racism to which some people are subjected by virtue of this conflation that, you know, back then it was you are Irish, therefore, and this whole set of rather corrosive assumptions would be made about you. Yes, I do think, and it those similarities are there in the structures of 21st century Islamophobia and other prejudices, and it's hard not to be rather deflated by that, because the one other thing about, you know, the experience of the Irish in Birmingham was once the mistake had been acknowledged, if there was a period of reflection and saying, look, we did get it wrong, we did castigate an entire hard-working community with the actions of a tiny number of people, that's a mistake we won't make again. Depressingly, I see we're making precisely the same mistake again. And remember, when we're talking about the Irish community in Birmingham, we're talking about the people who built the city in post-World War II. We're talking about the people who staffed the hospitals. We're talking about people who drove the buses and kept the entire infrastructure of the city's economy growing. These people aren't some kind of unwanted cancer on society. They're actually integral to making society work, as immigrant populations still are, and yet are still subject to the kind of racist castigation that we see. Disappointingly, I agree with the premise of your question that in 21st century Islamophobia, we do see strong echoes of what happened to the Irish in the second half of the 20th century.
Now, Chris, anyone who watches the footage on YouTube of the Birmingham Six being released in 1991, they'll see you right in the middle of the men, and they really acknowledge the role that you played in getting them released. But it's interesting, as you've spoken before, that around the time they were released, there was sort of a whispering campaign that the reason why they were released was because of problems with the investigation itself, not because the men were actually innocent, that the right men were in jail, but the police and the prosecution had gone the wrong way about convicting them.
Well, there was quite a lot of that about, yes. I have to say, going back to Birmingham again, that when I first went to Birmingham in about 1985, inquiring into this, the city was in total denial. The first person I contacted was the alleged crime correspondent of the Birmingham Post and Mail, who claimed never to have heard it even suggested that the wrong people had been convicted. Well, it had been suggested for 4 or 5 years by that time. He didn't necessarily have to believe it. But I realized after a while that really he saw his role as crime correspondent to be a spokesman for the police. And when the book was published in 1986, I found two copies in the main bookstore on a shelf labeled Irish Interest, as if someone going around alleging that the wrong people had been convicted of the biggest thing that had happened in Birmingham in many years was of no interest to anybody except a handful of Irish. The public library stocked one copy for which there was a long queue, and the regional BBC declined to refer to the book and the fact that someone going around saying he traced all four of those responsible for the bombings. Even though it was leading on central television, the independent television channel. I later discovered that the news editor at that time was a friend of the deputy chief constable, which explained a few things. Another thing that happened was, and I don't know how long this has been going on for, but it turned out there was an annual dinner held by the West Midland Serious Crime Squad, who were in trouble on many other fronts by this time, incidentally. And to it, they invited the local lawyers, local crown prosecutors, local journalists, including, I'm sure, the crime correspondent I've just referred to. And this dinner was due to be held 3 or 4 days after the release of the Birmingham Six. And I'm pleased to say it had to be cancelled at the last minute. But that had been going on for years, I think. And so there was a very tight relationship between different branches of the profession whose roles were supposed to be different, but somehow merged in a joint interest in not going too deeply into all this. And yes, in the legal profession as a whole, there was a whispering campaign from the day that the Birmingham Six were released, involving some of the highest judges in the land, that, well, we, okay, too bad that the forensic evidence was dodgy. And yes, we accept the police probably behaved badly, but we know they did it. As though there was some other bit of information around that had never quite seen the light of day that convinced them. And I think there probably was. I think MI5 or something had probably got something that they'd given to the judges before each of these trials. I can never pin that down. I don't know what it was, the basis. And I remember Sir Ivan Lawrence, who was the chairman of the Home Affairs Select Committee before I was. And he would come in after each of these convictions had been quashed and say, well, Chris, the word at the Old Bailey is that they all really did it. And after that had happened twice, it started with Guildford, then it was Birmingham. And then it was when the four innocent people convicted of killing the newspaper boy, Carl Bridgewater, had their convictions quashed. In came Ivan again. Well, Chris, the word at the Old Bailey. I said, Ivan, not for the third time, surely. But that's how the upper echelons, and Ivan was a part-time judge as well as being a QC. That's how the upper echelons of the judicial and police dealt with this for a long time. And of course, it made it very difficult for the police to start investigating who had actually done it. So not a lot happened. There was an inquiry set up shortly after the release, but before long, they appeared to be trying to reconvict the people who'd just been released. So that ran into the sand. And then they tried again in under pressure from the relatives. It was a very vigorous campaign by some of the relatives of victims. And I think they made a better effort this time. And eventually, of course, they came to my door and tried to get an order under the Terrorism Act 2000 to force me to disclose the identity of the one bomber whose identity I have not disclosed. And the judge kicked that out. Of course, a right to protect one's sources is a cardinal principle of investigative journalism. If I'd gone around saying, I'm sorry, I can't guarantee not to go blasting this all over the airwaves, your identity all over the airwaves, I don't think anybody would have talked to me. And the Birmingham Six would still be in jail, and some of the reforms to the legal system which occurred as a result of the Royal Commission that was set up as soon as the Birmingham Six were released, would not have occurred either.
Well, Chris, I think it's so interesting that we've seen all these huge miscarriages of justice in the 70s and the 80s regarding the Irish community. And you think, never again, this will never happen again. But then we've been looking over the past few years about the post office scandal and the parallels, the role that investigative journalism and the role that drama has played as well. It seems bizarre that we could be going through this again, with so many people on such a massive scale, another miscarriage of justice.
Well, the question, it is a key question, and Michael referred to the fact that the Muslim community is particularly vulnerable. The key question is, could it happen again? Some respects it couldn't. One has to pinch oneself to recall that until 1984, we could send people away to prison for life, and indeed in the 1950s, we could have hanged them and did on the basis of uncorroborated confessions in police custody, unrecorded confessions, just on the word of police officers. And certainly, I can think of two people who were hanged on that basis. The Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1984 makes that impossible now. They have to record confessions. And indeed, false confessions, though not absolutely impossible, are difficult to obtain. And they were the key to many of these most controversial cases. Forensic evidence has improved. The existence of CCTV makes a difference on ID evidence. The one thing that hasn't improved, it may have improved a bit, but it's not resolved, I would say, is disclosure, the rules on disclosure, the habit that prosecution and police have got into over the years of losing evidence inconvenient to their case. So in the Guildford case, for example, it emerged that several of those convicted had alibis, which they didn't know about, so they didn't sort of say, I've got an alibi. And it was those were only uncovered, many years later, once there were further investigations into what had happened. And but non-disclosure is a key feature of the post office cases. The fact that the computer system was capable of error, which the post office was in total denial about, and that was suppressed. And it does remain an unhappy fact that if you are the victim of a miscarriage of justice, you stand a better chance of overturning it if you go to an investigative journalist rather than a lawyer. Now, I don't complain about that. In a democracy, it's right that investigative journalists, serious journalists, should have a role. And indeed, there are some very good lawyers too, who one will go to in those circumstances. One thinks of particularly Gareth Pearce, who was key to many of these cases. But it is an unhappy fact that the mechanism for resolving miscarriages of justice is still flawed. And the post office case is the outstanding example of that. There's actually, interestingly, and I don't know enough about this case to make any assertions, there's a Birmingham case, becoming known as the Birmingham Four. Four young Muslims who've been sent down to very long sentences for planning terrorism, I think, is the charge. And it does seem clear that they had bomb-making equipment planted on them. Whatever else they were or were not involved in, I don't know. I haven't studied the case. But it does seem clear that somebody, not necessarily the Westminster Police, possibly MI5, planted bomb-making material on them. Now, that this can happen again in Birmingham, it is a bit worrying.
Yeah, so finally, I guess, Michael, have the lessons been learned?
Not in their entirety. I think what Chris was just saying there about, the people saying to him, well, of course, they may have got out on a technicality, but we think they still did it. That's a significant attitude. It's this attitude of you are Irish, therefore you are a legitimate subject of suspicion. I mean, Chris has been talking about the Guildford Four, but alongside them was the Maguire Seven, prosecuted for apparently making the bombs that the four then planted in Guildford. But if we look at the youngest of those convicted, that was Patrick Maguire, who at the time would have been a 13 or 14-year-old boy. And yet they were arguing that he'd somehow been active in the manufacture of bombs. Now that spreads fear and paranoia. So if I was a 13 or 14-year-old boy, growing up Irish in Birmingham, was I a legitimate object of suspicion then? And I think this we have to accept there's a very, very deep-rooted perception of Irish people in British society. Edward Said, the Palestinian academic, wrote about this very well in Cultural Imperialism, basically showing how from the mid-12th century onwards, there's this idea of somehow the Irish being savage and barbarian is deeply rooted in British culture. So yes, we've learned legislative lessons and the idea of the Police and Criminal Evidence Act having to tape record interviews. You would think that there's better safeguards in place, but they don't create the conditions in which it's no longer possible to imagine a similar miscarriage of justice. Now, I think perceptions of Irishness changed notably in the 1990s with this kind of weird kind of culturally fashionable Irishness, where these proliferation of Irish pubs in British towns and cities, which look nothing like any pub in Ireland I've ever been into. So I'm not sure that was always a healthy thing. So there's been a slight shift in attitudes towards Irishness. I wonder how much it would take to dredge up those more questionable historical discourses, given how deep that colonial relationship runs. We've learned some lessons. There are more lessons to learn, and let's keep the narrative and the educative process going.
That's been a fascinating discussion, and we are coming up now on the 50th anniversary at the end of this month of the Birmingham bombings. I'd just like to say thank you very much once again to incredible guests, Chris Mullen, and everyone can get the new edition of Chris's groundbreaking 1986 book, Error of Judgment, The Truth About the Birmingham Pub Bombings. And that should be available online or wherever you get your books. And Dr. Michael Flavin, two of his books, You May Want to Get the Voice Hearer and One Small Step. And we're really looking forward to his new book that's going to be published next year. And that has a big Irish theme to that as well, and the Troubles-based theme, doesn't it, Michael?
Yeah, it's set in spring 1988 when the killing of by the SAS of three IRA volunteers in Gibraltar was followed by a lone loyalist attack at their funeral at Milltown Cemetery. And one of those funerals, two plainclothes British Army corporals inadvertently drove into the funeral cortege and were set upon by the crowd. So a particularly troubling phase in that. So yes, that book will see the light of day next year, I hope.
So once again, Chris and Michael, thank you so much for coming on. And just to say that if you like this episode, you can find this and all our previous episodes on our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. If you get a chance, please rate and review the show on Spotify or iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. So on behalf of myself, Cathal Brennan, and my co-presenter, John Dorney, thank you very much for listening.
Radio.ie hosts the Irish History Show podcast because history matters. Radio turns 100 years young this year. Radio's history is powered by Radio Archives. For radio archiving solutions from people passionate about radio, visit radio.ie.